of these like supplementary course materials, especially since you're like a student here and you have a lot of like your Aero-Astro, right? Which for our listeners, Aero-Astro is like the hardest major at MIT. It's like really, really hard. So have you been getting a lot of outside help with developing the curriculum materials? And have you gotten a lot of MIT student volunteers or outside volunteers or?
Right. So, just to give a clear perception, I think all majors at MIT are really hard. I mean, I'm pretty sure that we all pull all-nighters every now and then. So I wouldn't really say that Core 16 is just the hard one. Moving on to your question about the work, yes, it is a lot of work, definitely, because, it's not just creating the videos. You have to spend a lot of time brainstorming what kind of video you want. What is the element of the video that you want? Because in the end of the day, the material present in the video should be effective for the students. You cannot just give any random example that you want. The physics should be consistent, because while you're teaching it, it's something that they're watching, so you don't want to give them the wrong information, because then they will end up getting the wrong image and the wrong impression about the subject matter. So definitely, we do have to spend a lot of time in sort of designing the content of for iSchool, but in that I've had a lot of help. In fact, Professor Dermeshkin, as I was telling earlier, from our physics department, who takes 801, course 801 here at MIT, he has been helping a lot. He has been helping me in designing the subject content of iSchool, and he has been basically giving me support in terms of the kind of examples, the kind of displays that we should have in the iSchool videos. Apart from that, in the actual work of creating the videos and giving the voiceover, it's really the volunteers. I mean, I myself am more engaged with the overall architecture of the program. So I have to do a lot of work related to bringing people in iSchool program and sort of, taking them into the program. And besides that, we also have to make sure that the people get their questions answered, the volunteers get their questions answered. They have to know sort of what's going on. So I have to run around, do a lot of that work. But the volunteers are then trained often by the older volunteers who do the work, who have been engaged with the program for a while. And that way we sort of make sure that the knowledge is transferred from the previous generation of volunteers to the current generation of volunteers. And that's really how we are doing the program for now. We also conduct some workshops, and we have had help from some organizations who have provided us some sort of help in the preparation of the PowerPoint slides. So far, those are the resources that we have been using.
Thanks so much, Ketan. We're actually finishing up Sperio now, but thanks so much for telling us your story. It was great hearing about it, and I would encourage listeners to contact Ketan at the email he gave us if you're interested in getting involved.
very welcome. Very, very welcome. You are here on Music for Human, where we have whale music and other musical things. Ah, how gentle the whales sound on this fine evening. I am Dr. Jalis Sakran here on Music for Human. Music for Human is New Age Talk Radio with an emphasis primarily on ourselves, but eventually also on you, the listener of Music for Human. Ah, what music those creatures of the sea make. Well, I'm joined primarily first by a returning host, Professor Smith, Lee Smith, traveling cowboy, philosopher. Professor Smith, welcome.
Howdy.
Welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
So, you've been described as a cowboy and also as a philosopher, which I understand is rare.
I wouldn't say that's true. Out there on the range, there's a lot of time to oneself. I think maybe all cowboys are philosophers, all real cowboys.
That's an unusual take, but perhaps should not be surprising coming from a cowboy.
Philosopher, right.
Well, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We also have returning Professor Zina Pfannkuchen. Professor,
evening.
Welcome.
Good evening.
Now, Professor Pfannkuchen's expertise is on neologistics.
Yes, I specialize in Marxian neologism, and specifically in the spirituality of materiality and the materiality of spirituality.
A sort of give and take there.
A dialectic, if you will.
Very nice. Thank you for joining us. And we also have Professor Levine, mystic Jewish person. Welcome, Professor Levine.
It's a very deep pleasure of mine to be back, and I know I've been away for several weeks. I've been absent, and I'm not exactly sure where I've been. I've been absent even to myself, and I've really missed myself.
And now, are you finding yourself as you return to the air?
I'm in the process of finding myself. I think it's a long process.
That sort of self-discovery happens again and again.
Right, and usually when we talk about self-discovery, we're referring to understanding ourselves. But in this case, I'm actually talking about finding myself.
About finding your lost self.
Right, since I actually have no memory of what happened over the last 5 or 6 weeks at all.
So you've actually forgotten. What is the last thing that you do recall?
Well, I remember being on the show several weeks ago. I'm not sure if I left the studio after the show. It sort of gets a little fuzzy. And the next thing I remember is I'm eating a burrito.
Do you remember where or what sort of burrito?
Well, it was a very spicy burrito, mostly composed of hot sauce with a little bit of beans and rice. I was eating it on the ground in Harvard Square, in the middle of the street.
So here in town?
Yes, in Boston. In the Boston area. And I'm not sure if I was in the Boston area for the intervening 6 weeks or not. Just not entirely sure what happened.
Did you have a kind of Proustian Madeleine moment with this burrito, bringing you back to earlier burritos?
Yeah,
perhaps that you'd eaten in the station.
That's right. I did decide to dip the burrito in my coffee a little bit. And it reminded me of my childhood.
That the dipping...
Yeah, not that I actually dipped burritos in coffee in my childhood, but somehow the act of dipping reminded me of the many dippings I had performed in my childhood, many kinds of dippings.
Now, I know you are a Jew. Does that mean that you would dip twice? Or is that only on a certain kind of holiday?
Well, I'm not sure about the double dipping. I know many cultures discourage double dipping.
Yeah, it's generally frowned upon.
Yes, it's considered to be a sign of a very coarse spirit.
I feel that this has just infused some classism into our discussion.
I assume was intentional on your part.
Well, I do like to keep it classy.
What is it that we mean by this term classy?
Martinis, usually.
I see. There's a certain degree of elitism and denial of the materiality of the, shall we say, proletariat in this term classy. I think we should interrogate this problematic term a bit further.
Well, I think we have to deny our own materiality to really gain enlightenment. Only after we have shed our spiritual materiality can we reach spirituality.
I would disagree. I do not believe that there's such an opposition that one must jettison the material or the physical. If you are a spiritualist and you believe that there are signs of some kind of higher power everywhere, would not these signs be also in the body, in the material, in the physical world?
Right, but the physical is just the matter that allows these patterns and these signs to exist, and true existence is really in terms of patterns. Just like I've heard many computer scientists say that hardware is not real, only software truly exists.
So that the number is the true thing, and the stones that represent the number are the shadow of the true existence.
Exactly.
Well, that just doesn't seem at all right.
I do believe that we must interrogate the real and realness and a kind of everyday assumption that the tangible is the only possibility. However, when I say material, I don't simply mean if you touch it, it is real. That is a very crude version of any kind of theory. But rather, we all live instantiated in material context that informs our ideas. And to remove our ideas from their material referent or their material context, that all these factors that influence the development and the production of knowledge, well, that's to do a disservice to our explorations here, spiritually and otherwise.
Well, I have no idea what you just said.
For my own explorations, and I think this thought came to me during my 5-week absence, because it was occurring to me as I was eating the burrito, is that it's really all about patterns and form. And of course this goes back to the ancient thinkers and philosophers and mystics who distinguished first between form and matter. So for example, we could have rocks on the ground, and what really matters is the pattern the rocks form, the geologic and the spiritual patterns. And I found this insight to be key in the ability to influence other people and to shape the world and other people's minds into that which is more conducive for our own spiritual enlightenment. So we have to recognize the pattern that's going on in each person. By recognizing the pattern and ignoring the matter, you can influence it.
I think that there are many ways to influence people. I was recently revisiting a text by Robert Lifton, because as you may know, there's been some recent conversation about de-alerting and even disarming nuclear weapons stockpiles from the United States and the former Soviet Union, now known as Russia. And Robert Lifton, of course, is a major theorist, sociologist of these matters from the Cold War era, and particularly the nuclear psychology. And I was fascinated by an article of his going back, I believe it's even to the early 1960s, in which he describes ways to control a mind. He's talking mainly about communist China, but these apply equally to the United States at that time during the Cold War, and I believe that, you know, continue to apply in any state apparatuses.
Well, are these psychological techniques or parapsychological techniques?
I think that you could describe them as both. I think that for him that there's a blurry, permeable boundary between the two. But he also talks about context. For example, the very first that he lists is controlling influences from media. That is to say, isolate some people or group of people such that they cannot experience any outside news media. Once that's done, then once that information is controlled, then that's the first step to truly controlling someone's mind.
Well, I've read in the parapsychological literature that there are essentially two types of people. There are skeptical people and naive people. And each has a different reaction pattern to arguments that try to convince them to change their mind.
But Dr. Pfannkuchen, what do you do with the mind once you control it?
I don't make a point to control minds. I would engage critically and anti-hierarchically in an attempt to move towards an autonomous and consensus-based system in which we don't subject people to that kind of control.
I see.
Now, obviously, there are always power relations at play, such that we cannot fully escape regimes of control, regimes of power. I am not so naive as to say so. However, we can make critique, and that's what I do.
But isn't
I do.
The critique itself a form of control?
I believe it engages power relations, but transversely.
Well, you know, a form of control that we have here on Music for Humans is that we give out the phone number, and then we encourage our listeners by controlling them to call in. So our number is 617-253-8810, so please call immediately. Seem to work.
I think I may have actually caused that by accident. I was sending off a certain vibe, which led the caller to hang up.
I see.
Sometimes the powers of influence are hard to control.
That's true. Yeah. So there's this problem of controlling your instrument of control.
Exactly.
Which is subtle.
I find this word control to be fascinating in that in German it means to control someone that is at the ticket, at the station. If one enters the subway and has no ticket and there's someone, a controller, who comes by and you get controlled, that, you know, then that is an illegal act that has been made illegal by the fact of not having a ticket. But it is really not until one is controlled that its illegality is made apparent and made official and recognized by the state.
Well, let's try once again to control. Hello, marhaban caller, you are on the air.
Hello.
Marhaban, hello.
Hello, I'm calling in from Arizona.
Welcome from Arizona.
Thank you. My name is Joan, and I was real interested in your discussion about control.
Yes, and do you feel, caller, that you were controlled or compelled somehow, at least encouraged mildly or nudged properly?
Well, I mean, your words were real interesting, and they caused me really to call in. That's what really did it. But, there was something in my head that told me I had to call in, but I think that's pretty normal, right? I mean, I don't like the idea that you guys can, like, just think a little bit or stare off into space and light candles or whatnot and just cause me to call in.
Well, we try not to abuse our abilities, I think.
And I think you underestimate exactly how difficult it is for Professor Levine here, who is now red in the face and sweating profusely from the effort of control.
Now, I wonder if the caller herself has ever exercised some sort of control or influence over others.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, apart from my feminine wiles, you know, I guess that's a type of control, but nothing real untangible.
Well, of course, the use of feminine wiles to control is a very ancient art, I think, going back to the Kama Sutra. And there have been many popular books written recently on the training, let's say, of a husband. So I know that one woman who was involved in exotic animal training came to the conclusion that she could apply the same techniques to her husband. And the basic idea was to constantly use positive reinforcement.
So you could, like, make your man sit whenever you want him to and then take down the toilet seat just by, like, blowing a whistle or something?
Something like that, yeah. Through positive... basically, the idea was to treat him as a wolf or a dog or a child, and to give him biscuits or other forms of approval for, say, washing the dishes.
Well, like, cats can do something like that, right? Like, I heard that whenever a cat's hungry and it looks at you all pitiful-like, you know, that you are forced to feed it.
So there is a... I guess what you are hypothesizing, caller, is that even though, you know, people perceive the cats as their possessions, that in fact the reverse relationship exists, that the cat has somehow learned through a mechanism of control to eat and to be housed very cheaply and inexpensively.
And sometimes what you see close down to the border is a different kind of possession, where the cat will possess the owner in a totally different way.
A possession.
The border with Rhode Island, we're referring to.
That's correct.
Now, possession here implying like a spiritual entering.
That's right.
A consumption spiritually, which we've discussed many times.
To, like, eat the cat?
Not to eat, not to consume, you know, not to digest the animal, but instead to light candles and perform various rituals to enter the cat in a spirit form and thereby control it wholly.
Of course, the history of sorcery and witchcraft is really closely connected to this idea of trying to control others. One of the most common goals of using the black arts was to make someone fall in love with you through some sort of potion or spell or charm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed that Dr. Pfannkuchen is sweating, so let's see if we have another caller on the line. Caller 2, marhaba.
Hey.
Yes, welcome to the air.
Hi, I was listening to you guys talking about eating cats, and so I wanted to talk about my personal movement to legalize cat eating in the United States.
Is it really illegal?
It's illegal to you know, go into someone's house and take their cat and eat it. And in other cultures, it's basically like one of their main dishes. And for example, in South Korea, their national dish is called pussy pot pie. And you can't get that in the United States. So if you're South Korean and you're coming here and you want to invest a lot of money in, say, for example, subprime mortgage loans or something like that, then you can't do that because you're so upset about not being able to eat cat intestine.
Well, caller, I wonder if it may more appropriately be called neighbor's cat or something, because, you know, as far as I'm aware...
Yeah, it should.
It's perfectly legal to eat your own cats and kittens.
I actually believe that it is illegal in most of your states because of cruelty to animals laws. And in fact, I think that the largest animal on which you can, kill and dine without any kind of regulation is the lobster.
I believe it's the whale.
What about...
There is white regulation with regards to
whales.
What
about bovine consumption or equine consumption?
There are regulations on how you can...
But it is not illegal.
What if it's a kitten? Like, a kitten's going to be smelling the lobster, right?
What about,
yeah, that's true.
What about eating dinosaur bones? I mean, is it illegal to, say, break the bone and gnaw on the cartilage of a dinosaur?
I started making clones out of them.
Well, I think I would be interested in new genetic techniques which combined with a spiritual possession that we've been describing can be used to, there is new literature on growing burger meat in a lab using chemicals and DNA from a burger.
Stem cells.
Precisely, that it would be also possible to encourage the splitting and sort of dissection of the burger soul or spirit, and then endow the new burger with a spirit which could then be slaughtered and yield very delicious yields.
Well, guys, I gotta go. That's making me hungry. So
yeah.
Well, thank you so much, caller, for joining us.
And good luck with your cat, man.
I appreciate it. Go to www.pussypotpieXXXeducation.org to learn more.
I'd like to share a story about whales. I recently was hearing a story from someone involved in the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute about a particular mammal who's the only mammal ever to have given birth by mouth. It was a female whale who was pregnant and was hit by some kind of ship and got very tangled up in the propellers, but survived briefly. Mm-hmm. And her internal injuries, though, were so great that all of her organs swelled up, and the only opening through which they could be expelled was the mouth. So she slowly, over a period of hours and days, vomited up all of her internal organs, including this fetus.
Mm.
And of course she died. But the calf was alive. It ultimately died eventually, but it was alive when it was born.
All things die, yes, eventually. Let's bring another caller in to share the experience. Caller 3, welcome.
Malibaji.
Marhaban, is this Ms.
Arthur here?
Arthur Rainbow Beam, welcome.
Yeah, I had a field report to bring to the show.
Please bring it.
Well, as a lot of our listeners know, Robert McCorkle just recently passed away. Robert, known as Bobby, was the guy who introduced America and the rest of the West to ear candle therapy. He brought that over and turned it into a new thing, so that when you walk down Madison Avenue or Market Street, wherever, and you put apps with crystal sonic therapy, all the standard stuff, and then like the special deals on ear candle therapy, it was him who started that whole thing off. And I went to his funeral in London, and it was just the most spectacular thing. I think the highlight actually happened in the plane on the way back. I had this epiphany. We were flying, just starting our trip in the Atlantic Ocean, and the pilot said that if you look out your window,
Arthur, I'm afraid we lost that last bit.
But I would also, until Arthur gets back to us, like to comment that I also find funerals to be extremely uplifting experiences, contrary to the most people's views. I think funerals can be
free beer.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it all depends on the attitude of the
funeree.
It's difficult to take a philosophical view sometimes, but it can be very helpful. I think Arthur is trying to reconnect. Let's try to form the connection again. Arthur, are you there?
Malibaji, how far did we get? I didn't know I got cut off.
You were saying that the pilot was telling you to look out the window.
Look out the window, yeah, right. Yeah, you know, that I'd only sit in the clothing catalogs, but it's a real place, and, you know, it just got me thinking about perspective, because our trip was just starting, right, going across the Atlantic Ocean, so it really wasn't land's end, it was land's beginning. Mm. Coming in to London, and then...
So how does that compare to Shangri-La or El Dorado or Atlantis?
you know, it was pretty foggy, and I saw some green splotches and some rocks down there. It's kind of hard to tell up in a plane, but it's more just that difference in perspective, you know, like looking from America versus Europe, you know, looking west towards looking east.
Yeah, they're scary.
Yeah, but it was really an incredible funeral, just really moving.
Now, Arthur, I'm aware that in many recent funerals, it's become fashionable to hand out portions of the remains to the particularly close members of the, you know, the deceased's family or friends, in the form of test tubes containing ashes or occasionally diamonds.
You know, it's interesting they didn't do that here, but he did have his own ceremony worked up for his own death and his will. It was kind of split.
This is assuming that he actually passed away, because it has become a very popular spiritual event in the life of a devotee to fake one's own death in order to fully disengage from the world.
Well, I don't think it was a wax model in a coffin, because one thing they did for the ceremony, which was so moving, is that they lit an ear candle. You know, they had him turned on his side and lit a candle right there in his ear.
I was reading in the Time magazine about someone who engaged in the ultimate form of asceticism by faking his own death, collecting a few million dollars in life insurance and running away and starting a new life with his family and coincidentally in Rhode Island near the border. And he was caught and sent to prison for many years. But it led him to, you know, the less is much more lifestyle.
I find that many people are participating in multiple identities, and they frequently engage in a kind of controlled death by killing off certain aspects of their personality and birthing new ones.
Yes, and I find that this...
Eating too much corn,
but also this can be practiced through the actual physical dismemberment of part of one's body. So, for example, if you'd like to symbolize the withering away and the death of one identity or aspect of your personality, you can ritualize this by cutting off a pinky, let's say.
Or in the example of transsexual surgeries, I think this is probably the most socially acceptable and prominent example where a surgery and is often co-conspiratorial, or it is significant to the changing of a name, and that naming is supposedly naming a type of body part that one is perhaps having as a result of having a certain name, and that that changing a name and changing a body are processes that
you mean there's like actual physical redefinition along with redefinition of the person.
But I agree with the good doctor here that indeed we could just as well cut off amputate another piece of the body, a finger or a nose or an ear, change a name as, you know, this is myself without an ear.
And ultimately, as the medical technology catches up with the medical philosophy, there will, I'm sure, be amputations of larger and larger parts of one's head to sort of...
What I can say, you know, I don't think this is a get-rich scheme on his part. He was already a pretty wealthy man from bringing ear candles to the West. But what was so interesting to me about the ceremony, and something I never thought of, was just the idea of lighting that ear candle, you know, as a preparation for the afterlife. Just lighting the candle and kind of shaking the wax out of his body,
and
so
really,
that he could have clean ears.
So the wax of the candle merges with the wax of the ear
it's the whole idea that, you know, you reach God through your ears, and having those clear ears is just so critical.
No, absolutely, and so many
hotspot of the body.
So many ears are full of a gray, dry wax that is not suitable for ear candles, and I'm not sure what message that he was bringing to those people. You know, because for the people that have brown, moist wax, I mean, he had a message really of light and of clear hearing in the afterlife.
Hmm. Well, I just wanted to share with the listeners the story of my own pinky. I've lost, I'm missing it from the first knuckle down. And that is the result of an identity and name shift that I had myself. I used to be known as Professor Goldberg. But once I ventured into the New Age, straying a bit from my Jewish roots, I decided that name sounded too Jewish, so I switched to Professor Levine, which I think is somewhat less Jewish sounding. And along with that transformation, I removed...
You got rid of some of your Jewishness.
Pinky. Yeah.
It's a sort of second circumcision, if I may, circumcising the Jewishness.
Well, at least merging the Jewishness with the world spirituality.
Now, what did you do with the finger?
That's just so close, though. That's, you know, circumcision as a way to form a covenant with God, combining that to melting the wax out of your ears. It's so similar.
And of course, in some religious traditions, I think including both the Jewish tradition and the Islamic tradition, there's discussion of circumcision of the heart, where if one circumcises their heart, it means that they remove the impurity of their heart. And I think some people with modern cardiac surgeries have actually been able to perform a physical version of this heart circumcision.
A cardiectomy. Now, unfortunately, many people hearing the term circumcision of the heart or circumcision in general have this impression that the entire organ should be removed, which has led to, I understand, several accidents and lawsuits. Did you actually cut off the entire pinky or simply remove the sort of tip?
No, as you can see, I removed the outer two joints. So I still have a little stub going up to the what was originally the first joint. And I did this in two steps, actually, because I felt it was a gradual process of changing my identity. So first I removed the pinky from the first knuckle.
And that also enables you to turn back in the middle of the procedure.
Right. Of course, I went through with it all the way, and I have both of these joints stored in my house in a secret location, which I can access whenever I'd like to sort of, you know, for nostalgic reasons.
Precisely. Precisely.
Just as one would keep an old love letter from an ex-girlfriend, I keep the pinky.
Right on the fridge.
Dude. Well, you know, it gets to be a little bit tricky because in Orthodox Jewish brisk tradition, the rabbi applies, you know, pressure and sucks with his mouth, and that can cause herpes and all kinds of other issues. This has been a big problem in New York City.
Beeline
just,
AIDS.
On the street.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to break with one's roots.
It is, but you know, it's so easy to get just those little bumps on your cheek, and that can spread all over the body for a little baby and be permanent.
Yeah, but there's a lot. I mean, concealer is a lot better than it used to be, so I think that's why.
It is better. They use a tube now, so that there's no actual mouth contact, and with the tube, you know, they get like closed suction and can just suck.
Yeah,
and I mean, but it's not really orthodox. You know, they didn't have, you know, polyvinyl tubes back in those days. So I don't know.
They didn't have Mabel.
They didn't have herpes either.
I don't know if that's okay. Yeah, exactly.
Back in the good old days.
You know, yeah. I think that's what it is that when new circumstances arise.
Yeah, I think many of us are nostalgic for those pre-herpes days.
I mean, if you think about it, the FBI pretty much invented herpes to prevent circumcision.
Lyme disease also.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by Dr. Levine's comment that he did the surgery himself, and I think that there may be an important message of self-definition, literally and physically, in defining one's own body with the knife that is more significant, perhaps, than going to a surgeon or a moyel or a tattoo artist who would perform a certain kind of modification, even if it is voluntary, that actually physically taking the knife and cutting one's finger off.
Well, I think
could be an act of revolution and independence.
I think the technology is getting there, so that at-home appendectomy kits will be distributed soon. But unfortunately, you know, safe at-home surgery, it's just not really there.
Well, the mirrors aren't
for the
really
young
clear
surgeon
enough yet. I mean, I know some tattoo artists who like to perform their own tattoos people use a series of four or five mirrors to get a perfect view of what they're doing. But the mirrors just degrade when you have one mirror reflecting light from the other with current mirror technology. Mm-hmm. It's just not clear enough.
Yeah, and I understand that it's quite common for tattoo artists to put on their own tattoos, but somewhat less common, but not unheard of, for surgeons to remove their own organs if the occasion calls for it.
If they're an organ donor.
Or if they are just needing practice.
Although that Lost TV show on ABC, I think that doctor did it. Is that a documentary? Is that a drama?
Which?
Lost. You ever watch Lost?
What is Lost?
Some people on an island.
That was a nature documentary, right, about kangaroos.
It's loosely based on a true story that happened to the actors from the show Dollhouse.
Okay, and if you remember the lead doctor, I think he removes an appendix from his own cell.
Yeah, he was just hungry.
I think he was also hungry, so it's difficult to tell why he was doing that.
Yeah, the motive, you know, smoke monsters.
I mean, it's always difficult to understand why we do things. I mean, we can do some strange action and then rationalize it and say, oh, I did this for X or Y, but it's never definitive.
That's true. In that episode, in that hour-long feature, he was saying that he was hurting, but it's possible he wanted some delicious appendix.
I would like to share another story about whales. This one is...
I'm all earwax.
Yeah, please.
This whale is... this story is about a whale who was named Lucky, and she was named this by some ocean researchers because she had been hit in, you know, by a ship and had these terrible deep cuts in her, but she managed, despite these severe injuries, to live. This was something that she had sustained as a calf, and she grew into a new adult, you know, several years old. And then as an adult, became pregnant. And when she became pregnant, her body changed, as pregnant bodies do. And the old wounds, the scars, the pressure of the fetus inside of her, it pushed out against them, and the whale, the wounds became, they reopened up and they became infected. And when there was an autopsy, she died. When there was an autopsy performed, oceanographers were taking, these marine biologists rather, they took her body and they were just emptying out gallons and gallons of pus from these wounds. And they named her Lucky, and yet she ultimately died from these same wounds years later.
It may be that I've heard of some creatures being killed by an unfortunate name.
But you know, with death comes life too. It's something that's just weak.
Yeah, with gallons of gallons of pus comes life.
Some researchers played some. They did an experiment where they pumped Barry White music into a zebra shark aquarium at SeaWorld to see if it would, because there hadn't been any mating happening for a long time. I don't know why, they weren't getting to it. And surprisingly, it worked, and it actually disturbed a lot of the visitors. A very seemingly violent kind of mating dance.
I'm surprised that the same rhythms of the zebrafish would, you know, that they would be able to dance to the same beat, as it were, that humans can.
Yeah, I don't know if it's coincidence or what, but they blasted Barry White and did the trick.
It's been claimed that ostriches raised in captivity will refuse to mate because they find their human captors much more attractive sexually than their fellow ostriches.
I find that to be true about ostriches.
Oh, the reverse, you meaning?
No, I find human beings to be more attractive than ostriches.
Oh, I thought you were saying
so
that.
So I can't blame them at all.
When you're around ostriches, you won't be able to mate with other humans.
When I'm around ostriches, I will not be able to mate with ostriches, even if it meant procreation of the species.
But if no other humans were around, you would be able to.
That's right.
Because
presumably, frankly, I just have only been an ostrich in the company of other people. And I haven't been under any kind of special duress to mate with an ostrich.
We all know from Hollywood that cowboys can be very flexible in terms of their mating preferences.
Well, I think also part of the problem is the ostrich-human divide is so great that an incidental glance at one's arm will remind oneself that they are not an ostrich. And so what are you doing here?
I think with the right form of control, as we were discussing earlier, someone could be convinced, a human that is, could be convinced that he is an ostrich, and therefore maintain a same species attraction to other ostriches.
I think a mirror contraption would probably, I mean, if you're with the ostrich and you set up the right number of mirrors in the right configuration, if you thought you were looking at your arm, you would actually be looking at the ostrich arm and you would mistake it for your own arm.
But as you said earlier, mirror technology, not there
yet. It's getting there, but not quite there, in my own experience.
Well, it's a bright future ahead of us. Ostrich mating, self-surgery at home kits.
Mirrors.
Very, very shiny objects.
Cat.
I mean, at some point, the reflective powers of the mirror may be developed to the point where we could actually look at them, see our reflection, and comb our hair.
Look at the ostriches and comb our hair.
I think that what you're describing is a kind of positive feedback loop in which one's own reflection reflects upon itself, leading into a circle of self-reflection and discovery that can only allow us to reach higher dimensions with perhaps just a large enough number
right.
of mirrors.
I saw that in an art gallery once. I saw that in an art gallery once, and in fact, the exhibit exploded. That positive feedback loop of the image recurring on both sides of the glass, and a little boy just looked into it, and they had to close it down because it took weeks to clean up that little boy from
right.
all the...
Because currently with mirrors, you can only control your reflection, but your reflection can't control you. But ultimately what we'd like is to have it go both ways.
Mm. Right.
The dialectical process is lacking regarding mirrors.
Have you guys ever videotaped your own computer when the video camera's connected to it?
Exactly.
You know what you see? The movie The Ring starts playing.
That hasn't been my experience. What I saw actually was an ostrich. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier.
The ostrich was probably watching The Ring, though. You might not have seen that.
Well, a ring is perhaps similar to a positive feedback loop, except it doesn't actually go anywhere. It just cycles back upon itself.
Yeah.
Never increasing in magnitude.
Yeah. The only thing that increases is the, that stupid kid's career.
I would like to share another story about a whale.
I just wanted to wrap that one up, because, you know, my opinion is that however the math works out, that customer service is more important than 1,000 camels.
Or 1,000 whales.
Well, Professor, you mentioned before that whales, in passing, I think, that whales are a mammal. And I know that's more or less the consensus among marine biologists, but I just wanted to express a contrary view. And I personally believe that they're reptiles.
Curious.
I mean, because mammals can't swim usually.
Can you not swim?
That's a good point.
Well, they can swim, but not. They can't live their entire life in the water.
Maybe we just have not tried that. We've a limited supply of land, and I think it's perhaps something that is worth exploring.
The theory from evolution is that whales left the water along with all mammals, and then decided to go back into the water. And I find that a bit far-fetched, personally.
Have you ever seen the philosophical thought experiment Waterworld? It came out in the 90s, I believe. The work of Professor Costner.
I am not a biologist, merely a neologist, but I find this concept of a water world or a Wasserwelt fascinating.
Age of Aquarius.
Alternative.
Exactly.
Yeah, what I like is when you say it in German, it really imbues the idea with deep conceptual and philosophical content.
Because of the hidden ancestry of English.
That's probably right, but I think, languages are all... Each language has its own mystical property that, when used, imbues reality with a sort of shadow. And I think the shadow that German casts on words is a sort of deep philosophical and scientific feel.
I find that that is also true. I enjoy working with the German language. I also love the English language because there's so many words, more words than any other language that I have experienced.
Right. And the nice thing about English is no matter what you say, it sounds like a pop song.
In English?
Yeah. Just like Madonna or Britney Spears.
Just like what you just said there.
It could have been the lyrics in a pop song,
no
right?
No matter what you say.
That sounds beautiful.
Actually, I think that's already a song, if I'm not mistaken.
It may be.
Miley Cyrus? I think she just came out with that.
I think the problem is that even though there are so many words in English, there are probably more pop songs than phrases. So,
so no matter what you say,
it's already been made into a pop song.
It's been made, and it's probably won a Grammy.
Or is otherwise very successful in an underground way.
I believe it's already successful in an underground way, actually won the 1887 Grammys for best song.
Yeah, it was second to Michael Jackson's, won the 1987 Grammys for best song that year, I think, so.
Yeah, I remember 1987.
Hey, humans, we're stuck in traffic. I think I gotta phase out.
Well, thank you so much for joining with us, Arthur, once again.
And I know that we've had some other caller who's been trying to contact us, but our lines were full. But I think now we might have an open line for anyone else who wants to call.
It's very interesting seeing Professor Levine work on his subtle methods of control. And is our other caller still there?
Oh, I'm still here.
Well, I wonder, yeah, have you ever practiced any form of influence or nudging or mind control?
Mind control? I haven't really had a lot of success at it. I think my brain's a little bit smaller than most people's, that's what my doctor said. So he said keep trying, but you might need a lot more help. So I've been buying a lot of wands recently and seeing how that works.
Well, the other thing I think is this this issue about ear candles being very important. I alluded to this earlier, but I understand that from the work of Bobby McCluskey, that he found that there were two types of people: those who had wax that was suitable for candle making, and those who did not. So, caller, do you have the sort of gray dry wax, or are you a brown moist wax person?
I'm actually a dry black waxer. Not suited for ear wax or ear candles.
It's a sooty wax. It's like you've been used up.
Ashy.
That's akin to the the 1996 documentary. Is that The Shadow? At the end of that movie, descendant of Genghis Khan loses part of his brain and can no longer perform telekinesis. And that video documentary, that movie, says a lot to your particular issue. It's possible you don't have that brain matter.
It could also
that
be
ear
that
matter.
There's a small fire inside the caller's head, which is producing soot.
Well, actually, I pretty much know what my problem is. In a while ago, I was in an accident where I was working on the railroads, and some dynamite went off and put a railroad tie right through my head. So it went through the bottom of my chin and out the top of my head, and it took off a lot of my prefrontal cortex, and the specific part of the prefrontal cortex where telekinesis is located in humans. So that's what my doctor told me.
You seem to have recovered your speech faculties.
Oh, I never lost them. You know, I drove myself to the hospital. You know, I checked myself in, filled out my own forms.
Well, it said that
watched a lot of Leno.
The brain is largely redundant in that most of the other organs of the body can actually compensate for the brain's activity. So, for example, one can drive without any input from the brain for at least several miles.
Yeah.
Just coasting, like the rooster who's been decapitated.
Right. I mean, the driver can make turns and even signal the turns and follow basic traffic rules.
Yeah, I think also what surprises people in the Western view of medicine is that certain of these aspects are stored in other nerves away from the brain. So, for instance, I'm aware that certain elements of mind control are stored in the second and third joint in the pinky, which may explain why Professor Levine has been having such difficulty all evening.
I have tried to rustle up another caller, and I've been mentally searching the vicinity for a receptive mind, and I just haven't found someone weak enough at this point, at least within a 100-foot radius, since my powers are relatively limited.
Well, you know, that might be a lot of my fault, because though I don't have any telekinetic powers, all of my energy is focused into blocking. It's sort of a jamming, telekinetic jamming. So, I mean, that's part of it. And I've also kind of just not eating cats. It's kind of my energy is all over the place, and it's kind of like trying to operate around a lightning storm. So my whole family has been kind of affected by that in that way. And, you know, we're probably related, so...
Well, caller, sadly, we are reaching the end of the hour. If you are still there, we do hope that you have better luck in feline meat acquisition.
Yeah, make sure to check out the website, which is www.eatingu.biz.org.uk.
Well, thank you so much, caller. We'll be sure to do that.
Okay. Great.
And thanks also to my co-host this evening, Professor Pfannkuchen.
Thank you, Doctor.
And Professor Levine.
Thank you for having me.
And our cowboy philosopher, Lee Smith.
Thank you.
I am Dr. Jalis Sakran here on WMBR 88.1 FM in Cambridge, with Music for Humans. Music for Humans is New Age Talk Radio with an emphasis on you. Stay tuned for Massachusetts Bay Transit Authority and friends. Ma'asalama.
Safety.
Number one,
cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two,
look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three,
cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four,
cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians and unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
And I'm Brad with Response.
It's 15 minutes of sounds from Squandam Point Park, the pile of rocks reappropriated during World War I to build Navy destroyers. Airstrip again, stereo microphone, hold it in my hand, spin around really slowly, quarter revolution for 15 seconds, trying to figure out what being there has to do with the past.
I'm looking to find things that you would normally see in everyday life that you don't normally associate with music, and tracking objects within the video, computer-generated music.
Combined sound of ambience, film, and
don't forget to put your headphones on.
Turn the volume up.
Otherwise, you're gonna think we're crazy.